It was always part of the plan to put a brewery in, but for many years it was just a plan.
It's 100% acquisition of Green Beacon.
No, we had a chat with everybody.
Anyone would have seen this coming a mile away.
You know, the passion and the dedication to beer and brewing.
Oh, yeah. That's super simple and direct question.
It's always fun to get to speak about beer.
And thanks to our malt mates at Crymalt, I'm Matt Kirkegaard, and that's just what we're here to do, talk about beer. And this week, a long-awaited chat with Peter Phillip from Wayward Brewing. Now, Peter is no stranger to readers of Brews News or to listeners of this podcast through his role as chair of the Independent Brewers Association. As an industry-focused publication, this is possibly overshadowed, his role as founder of Wayward Brewing Company, one of the earlier breweries to Sydney's inner west. Today, we rectify that and speak to Peter about building a brewery from nomad to powerhouse in just 9 years. Peter Phillip, welcome to Radio Brews News.
Thanks, Matt. Great to be here.
Mate, we did speak to you just a couple of months ago now in your role as chair of the IBA, but today it's very much in your role as founder of Wayward Brewing, but just as I was reading that out, I did pause and sort of think, how hard is it to switch between hats from head of the industry association, taking every brewery's focus on board, and then going back to your own brewery and thinking, well, these are the troubles that I'm facing in my business that are a little bit unique to others?
Well, I think I got involved with the IBA because, you know, as a small brewer, business owner, I had concerns. And I thought we were able as an association or a group of brewers to work together. And so, you know, it was selfish in one way because, you know, I wanted to make change happen. So I thought it's no good whinging about things on the sideline, just get involved. And I think that was about 5 years ago now.
You know, and it's a huge commitment. You see both sides when you sit where I sit. I see how much time you have to take out of your own business that, you know, any small business person is thinly spread at the best of times. And same with guys like David Kitchen in Queensland that I observe very closely. But then when you are fronting the IBA and you're often doing the media, you do hear people sort of saying, oh, look, there's Peter sort of in his wayward shirt again. And I don't think that you get full respect for the opportunity cost involved in your business of being involved in the national association.
Yeah, look, it particularly during COVID, the workload was enormous. And, you know, I took over from Jamie Cook he was chair during a time when we didn't even have a GM. So that was a real challenge. And it was kind of just, I guess, a fortunate thing that he was taking a step back from day-to-day management at Stone & Wood at that time, which I'm definitely not. I'm still involved very much day-to-day, and, it's owning a small business is a 24-hour job. But, you know, I guess at the other side of it, you know, owning the business does give me the flexibility to organize my day around what's happening. So it is a challenge. It does chew up a lot of time. It's getting much, much better now that we've got Kylie on board, our GM, now CEO, actually. So we've promoted Kylie to CEO because she's doing such an outstanding job. And so that's taking a lot off my plate, but she and I still work pretty closely together on all the advocacy and strategic issues.
There's a meeting coming up. The AGM will be coming up at some stage. Will you be renominating, or you've done your service?
It's a 3-year stint. I was nominated 5 years ago as a casual director. So that was something I did for almost a year. And then I was elected onto the board. And then in the last year of that, I was the chair. And then just because of so much change with COVID going on, the rest of the board asked me whether I would stay for another year. So, basically put myself up as a casual director, which is fine. The board can appoint casual directors. And so that's the but that's the end of my term. we're looking at a pretty major expansion at Wayward, so it's chewing up a lot of my time.
And that's the stuff I was thinking. There's a huge opportunity cost, but we might come back to the expansion. We won't. We'll sort of tease everybody with that to find out a little bit more about that, because that was certainly news to me. But we might jump into the Wayback Machine to 2012, when you first, because you were a home brewer and started contract brewing back then, or started Gypsy Brewing back then, or Nomad Brewing as the title is.
I guess the story is that, you know, my love of craft beer came from living in the UK. And when I was there, it was in the 90s. And like the London craft beer scene was really just in its nascence. BrewDog existed. But, you know, I'm going back to real original craft beer, which again is the beer you could drink in any pub in a little town in Devon or something like that, right? Where the brewery or the publican made his own beer, served it in a cask. You know, coming from a Canadian lager lout, you know, drinking Moosehead lagers was the most adventurous I got in Canada. And when I moved to the UK, I just went, whoa, what is this warm, flat stuff? And it just blew my mind. And then, you know, living in London, it was easy to get over to the continent. So, you know, trying things like Saisons and German Doppelbocks. And
so how old were you when this was all, when you're doing all of this?
Oh, that was in the late 90s.
Okay.
And I've been in Australia for now, since 97. So I've been here almost 24 years. So,
and are you willing to date yourself by telling us how old you were and, you know, how advanced your drinking had progressed by that stage?
I'm in my 50s now. So, okay. I've hit that five.
You're in good company there, just so you know.
Just going to Prague and having, a dark lager, you know, how can a lager be dark? I mean, so I was as green as you can imagine. And I just hoovered up everything I could possibly drink from the continent or UK, and beer tourism, and driving around all over Belgium, trying all these crazy beers. And so when I came to Australia, I was in the UK for 5 years. And then when I came to Australia, it was like, well, where are all these beers, all these delicious beers that I was drinking every day in the UK and Europe? Couldn't get any of them. So I just went, well, I've got to start making my own beer. So that's when I started homebrewing. And then, you know, like many other people, the hobby turned into an obsession. At one point, and my wife Yvette would get really pissed off because I'd, you know, take over the kitchen on weekends and it'd be an absolute fucking chaos of a mess. And it was always cleaner when I finished, right, than I started. But it was an absolute disaster in the middle of it. And she said, fuck, you've just got to get out. Can you, like, we didn't have a big enough shed I could brew in, and our house was quite small in Roselle, and you just got to get out of the kitchen. And I said, well, the only way I could do that is by starting my own brewery. Then I could have my own space. And she's like, whatever, just get out of the kitchen. So that was kind of like when the wife gives you permission to go and start a brewery, you know, you note that down and take a picture and get her to sign it. So we were kind of running out of space in that house. So we decided we were going to move and look for something bigger. We rented a place in Lilyfield for a while. It had a garage was my must-haves in the when we were renting and looking for a house. So, and that's where we started Wayward. So Wayward was literally started in a garage in Lilyfield. And she once told the story about how somebody showed up on the doorstep saying, can we buy some beer? And she's like, oh no, we're Gypsy Brewers.
Just before we go into the process of Gypsy Brewing, because as I look at your LinkedIn profile, you've worked for Oracle in the UK, but then you worked as CEO for Investment Link and SuperChoice Services, and you're a managing director of SuperChoice before you obviously went full into Wayward. That immediately raises questions about what your investment advice was like if you saw opening a brewery as a way to make money, or was this an antidote to your high finance world?
Well, I don't know if it was sensible investment advice or ideas. You know, that old saying, how to make a small fortune is start with a big fortune and start a brewery, right?
Yes.
By my background, I'm actually a bit of a computer nerd. So I owned a bit of a serial entrepreneur. I owned companies in Canada before I left for the UK. In the UK, I worked for Oracle, as you said. And then when I came to Australia, I was looking for a technology job and found a job in a technology company that was developing software for the superannuation industry. So although we worked in the superannuation industry, I really don't know much about investing and it's more about moving the money around and moving the data around in the super industry. But you know, that was a very good business that was involved with for about 15 years and still a shareholder of it. When it came to a point where my obsession was getting to that point where I just felt like I've just got to shit or get off the pot, right? So I was actively looking for space. When I was Gypsy Brewing, I think I'd stepped down as CEO at that point. And I am a non-executive director that made a mine who stepped up into that role. And then, you know, I was doing the part-time gig while we were getting the brewery. But once we found the location in Camperdown, then I was all in.
What was it that makes a little bit more sense that if you weren't on the investment side, because I don't think a numbers person would have ever sat down and gone, I could make money out of brewing. But coming from an IT background, that seems to have fueled a lot of our successful home brewing startups. Something about coding or something about computers that drives people to drink or gives them a love of making it.
I don't know what it is, but there is definitely, you know, I've got so many friends in the industry that have come from a computer background. We were talking about Dave Patton, you know, he and I were best mates when we were both working in financial services and would get together at Hart's Pub on two or three times a week and drink some good beer and have some chicken wings and talk about starting breweries. So we were both obsessed along a similar line. But yeah, there's a lot of people who have come from that. You know, Mike from Sauce is another one.
You didn't ever think of teaming up, because that would have been a fairly spectacular powerhouse, you and Dave working together.
This is probably a bit of history that not many people know. We actually seriously talked about it probably three times. And here's another funny story. Basically, I was being in the financial services industry. Some of my customers were in Melbourne. So I heard that Mountain Goat were selling their old brew house. So I called up Dave from Mountain Goat and said, oh, mate, I'll come down. I've got a business trip, so I'll come and visit you. And Patton said, oh, I'll come down with you. I need to come down as well. And I'd love to have a look at this. So we both looked at this. I had a place that we were looking at leasing in Roselle. It would have been a terrible location for a brewery. It was tiny. It was really, really... But, you know, you start getting desperate and looking at what you can do in any sort of space. I think it was only like 200 square meters. And so I was keen on buying the old Mountain Goat brew house. And then the lease fell through on this place. And Dave said, oh, I think I found a lease. Do you mind if I buy it? And so he bought it. And I think I dodged a bullet there, to be honest with you. It was a pretty shitty piece of kit. But, Dave pumped out loads of great beers out of that brew house. So it just goes to show you ingenuity is the mother of invention.
We can always make it easier, though. Make it easier to make good beer, can't we?
Exactly, yeah. There's a hard way and an easy way, and that brew house was absolutely the hard way. But yeah, we talked about it then, and then before Dave started Akasha, we very, very briefly revisited the idea. I think that what it came down to is that both Dave and I are control freaks, right? And we have enormous respect for each other, and we love what each other does. But, you know, it's really hard to have two captains to a ship. And when you have two very, very strong-willed individuals, it's either a recipe for disaster or a recipe for success. But, yeah, I think we could have made it work, but ultimately I'm, you know, very happy being a benevolent dictator in my business, and my staff call me that, so it's okay.
Now, when you when you did launch Wayward back in 2012, I believe it was, I believe you visited, brewed in just about every Sydney brewery. What did you learn from that process, and what did that teach you when you opened your own, when you went looking for your own space and opened your own space?
Good question. Look, I think when you, you know, going from a home brewer to big kit, right, is a shock and a surprise, you know, and as a gypsy brewer, you really don't get the experience that you do when you're brewing day to day on your own brewery kit, right? So I guess I had an opportunity to observe a lot of good brewers. You know, people like Sean, right? when we were brewing at Illawarra.
Yep.
I pretty much, although I did a couple brews with Asher, I think it was pretty much all brewing with Sean. And you know, I got to observe how that brew kit worked, and you know, talk to him about what worked, what didn't work. So I think when we designed our brewery, I pretty much knew what I wanted, and Sean certainly also knew what he wanted. So we collaboratively designed that, and I'm a bit of a closet engineer. So, you know, I love nothing more than getting into the detail of these things and really trying to design the optimal piece of kit. I mean, when I went over to China to look for a brewery equipment suppliers, you know, I saw stuff that, you know, I wouldn't make dog food in, let alone beer. And I just saw lots and lots of different ways to do it. We put some innovations into our brew kit that I haven't seen in many other ones. Like, for instance, our whirlpool is actually jacketed, so we can chill in our whirlpool. Which is kind of an old homebrewer trick, right? It's like you whirlpool your wort and put an immersion chiller in to chill it at the same time, which stops the your dry hops your whirlpool hops that you're putting into the whirlpool from volatizing. So little innovations like that have been responsible for creating some interesting brews at Wayward. So. Yeah, so I think, answer the question, it was fun brewing at all the different breweries and figuring out what we wanted, having a opportunity to play around.
It's amazing to say that, you know, in 2021, that, you know, 2012 was, you know, dog years ago in terms of the Australian brewing scene, and particularly when you look at how potentially crowded the Sydney's inner west is, or certainly how
not potentially
well it, It depends on who you ask. That's the thing. You know, the first people come in and say it's crowded. The more recent people will say, oh, look, you look how many people are enjoying it. It's a vibrant place. There's always room for one more if we, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats. But we'll call it Sydney's Inner West for now. You know, when you look at the clearer path that you had into the area, coming up with that homebrew phase, nomad brewer, opening a venue, did you have more luxury of starting small and experimenting and growing than if you lobbed into Sydney's Inner West today with the same business plan?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I thought we were late. We were, you know, I had already been planning on this for 2 years before we opened. So it was, I was getting very, very nervous that, well, God, we're missing the boat on this. I think we were the 10th brewery in Greater Sydney, right? And I don't know, I didn't even know what the numbers are now. What would it be? 50? Something like that.
I'll have to consult our database. It's going to be launched very soon.
Yeah. So it was, I thought we were late to the game. You know, we were desperate to find somewhere that we could, that met our criteria. We looked at, we had four leases that fell through just because of landlords that didn't understand brewing, couldn't get, you know, councils that didn't understand brewing, just so many false starts that when we found Camperdown, we, you know, I guess it was fate that we wouldn't get set up before then. Because we were looking at, we looked at a place that literally right across the forecourt from White Bay.
Okay.
And again, that would have been a nightmare of a site because it was too small as well. So I guess answering the question, yeah, I guess, you know, the market wasn't as well developed back then. So the rising tide has lifted all boats. And so that's a bigger market, so there's more opportunity.
Is that continuing to happen now, or are you finding that, particularly in regional, like for a brewery that has a tap room in a regional area, that can there be a saturation point or where it becomes too big?
I really like the regional model, right? I mean, in terms of sustainability of growth, I think that's where the sustainability comes from.
For new brewers, you mean? So
for new yeah. brewers, yeah. You know, it's like anybody who comes to see me, I say, you know, why don't you be the big fish in a small pond, right? Go and buy the old pub that's got a license. You can set up a brewery in the shed at the back. You can brew the beer, right? Because that's the other irony of starting a brewery is I started a brewery because I loved brewing, and I, you know, I actually did two brews when I was on holiday in Tasmania last month, maybe 2 months ago, just before lockdown, and I hadn't been on the tools for 3 years at Wayward. So, you know, I started a brewery because I love brewing, and I don't brew because.
Are you still homebrew, or it's too much like taking your work home?
No, again, my wife would kill me if I messed up the kitchen. But I keep threatening the boys that I'll do something on the pilot batch. Actually, I have a recipe written that I'm going to do, and you know, I did a brew with Will at Van Diemen, and one with Scotto at Hobart Brewing Company. So that was really fun getting back on the tools, doing a couple brews, so it reinvigorated me, and I'll start doing some more small brews.
I'm interested that you said you felt you'd missed the time when you opened, you know, 9 years ago, because you've been planning for a while. I guess you were then in that sweet spot when the pioneers had, for want of a better word, ploughed the field a little bit, but it hadn't been really crowded, so there was that growth that an area could have, I would hesitate to ever say easily, but more easily than perhaps now. Because I get the feeling that growth generally is a little bit harder. You know, that maybe there's only a set percentage of the entire market that wants to drink craft beer, for example. And, you know, we need to start looking at new places, like you said, the regional areas. Do you think that your area is still growing in terms of potential new consumers?
I don't really know how to answer that question, because I think that the Inner West is undoubtedly, you know, punching above its weight in terms of market share in Australia, right? So, I mean, IBA pegs our industry market share at about 8.2 last year. So it's going to have grown a bit. So let's call it 9 or approaching 9. But I would say that the Inner West is a multiple of that, right? So people in the Inner West, it's a bit like how in Portland, Oregon, it's a microcosm, or it's a little microclimate for the beer industry. And it's like something like 60% of the beer drunk in Portland is independent. Mm-hmm. So it's an amazing little microcosm. So I think the Inner West is kind of like that. I don't know whether it can continue to grow. I think that including breweries and planning that haven't opened yet, but have actually got spaces, I think we're up to 12 in Marrickville, right? Which is just like, that's higher density than Portland, right? If you look at it on a per capita basis. So is it possible to, I guess it's possible, but I do know it's getting much more competitive out there. We're a little bit out of the Marrickville triangle. So people coming to us need to seek us out, and we're a destination, I guess. Like us and White Bay, you know, so there is that black hole of Marrickville that really draws people in. It's a gravitational pull. Mm. But it is getting much more competitive. You've got to really have a full service offering to really get people interested. And then the on-prem is, you know, brutally, brutally competitive, to the point where, you know, it's almost a waste of time spending time on-prem, just because there's so many good breweries around that you're fighting against for such sparse amounts of taps that even if your beer sells great, you know, you're going to get rotated out next week when the kegs are gone. And so that's off-prem. You know, you only need now to look at the shelf space competition in bottle shops to see, wow, there's not much more room for bottle shops to expand because they're running out of fridge space.
Mm. And I'm not sure whether you catch the podcast, but I've talked a little bit just looking at BWS that this time last year, my local one, this time last year, it was all local lover, and they ranged a selection of them, and they look like they've got their data from that. And there seems to have been a bit of a culling, and the biggest competition for shelf space is from Endeavour's own brands, it looks like. So even that looks like it's going to be a very tough market longer term.
It's not going to get any easier, put it that way, right? Everything's going to continue to get much more competitive. So, and that's why I say to anybody who's thinking about starting a brewery, man, be a big fish in a small pond. It's a beautiful business model where essentially you're selling all the beer that you make 20 meters from where you make it, right? And that would be
quite scary, I'd imagine. Again, in going back to, you know, for some of the areas that don't yet have breweries, when you look at them, and I'd do a lot of tastings, well, before COVID, used to do a lot of tastings out in regional centres, and I'd still go out with the same enthusiasm of being an advocate and convincing people. And, you know, there's always a handful that are really interested in it because I've tried it before. Then there's the ones who are willing to try it. And then, you know, once you get out of that 15% of people who are in, you know, varying degrees of enthusiasm, then you start hitting the great mass of people who, oh, mate, this doesn't taste like, or this is too fruity, or this is this, or this is that. And you've got a much harder sell.
Too much flavor.
And that's, and again, like I think we've hit a lot of that in the inner city areas in terms of growth. But it would be scary for anyone wanting to invest to know that not only do they have to get their business started, but they also have to create their own markets in the way that Mountain Goat or, you know, the early, the pioneers did, you know.
But that's why it's important to know your market, right? Because, and I've spoken to, you know, when we had Good Beer Week and we had the Trade Hub, I spoke to a lot of young brewers that are starting in regional areas. And, you know, their most popular beer is basically an Australian light lager.
Yep.
Right. And so know your market. I firmly believe there's an independent beer for everyone, but there's not a craft beer for everyone. Right. So, you know, it's an important distinction that independent beer is not necessarily quote unquote craft. Right. Because the word craft beer turns some consumers off because they think, oh, you know, it's going to be like homebrew or it's going to be too flavorful or fruity or flowery or whatever, right? They've got a built-in, they tried one once and they didn't like it. And they went back to Tui's New and, you know, bless their cotton socks. That's what they like. So, you know, don't fight the tide, right? If that's what your customers want, because once you've got somebody inside your brew pub that's drinking your, you know, Resch's clone, right? And then, you know, somebody goes to the bar and buys them a light pale ale, you know, they might go, oh, you know, the typical response is, oh, that's not half bad. You know, oh, thanks very much. You know, that's a great compliment. You know, it's like, oh, it's not bad. And that's the way you convert people to more adventurous beers is by giving them a wedge or a ramp or.
But do we need to convert people to more adventurous beers? Because that's I guess the
big
question.
Not necessarily. That's it. I mean, if there is some amazing independent beers out there that are light Australian lagers, right? And they don't need to be anything else. As long as those businesses are independent, then all of those benefits of independence are happening, right? We're keeping money in Australia. We're buying Australian. We're supporting Australian jobs. All those sorts of things, right? So that's, you know, I'm passionate about independence and Australian made and independent beer, for all of those reasons. Because I just don't think we should have an industry that's dominated by foreign multinationals.
I mean, there's a whole lot there that could possibly be an IBA presentation as well. But I'm just fascinated because I've been to the point that people have actually started quoting it back at me or rolling their eyes when I say it, talking about that we're in a post-craft world these days. If you go back 20 years, it was that we're making beers that are different to the only beers you can get, you know, when you could only get a monoculture type of lager in various formats and various brands. That's where the craft beer moniker pointed out something different. Actually, I was interviewed on ABC Radio last night about it because they wanted to know what it was. And I said, well, I think craft has actually outlived its usefulness because it's not the big brewers have lifted their offering. And, you know, you can get an amazing array of beers exclusively from big brewers. And the conversation has moved to other elements of or other attributes of brewing about, you know, do you want to have a brewery that's local to you? Do you want to have a brewery that you know the people? And, you know, they're the sort of conversation. So I was very interested to hear that you said that.
I mean, it's like if you, you know, I try to exclusively buy Australian when I'm shopping for groceries, let's say, you know. So I'm sure that Mexico makes excellent garlic, but I won't buy it because I want to buy Australian garlic, right? I don't care if I'm paying 20% more, or I really don't care how much more I'm paying, because at the end of the day, whether it's $1 or $1.50, really, do you care what it's 50 cents, right? But it makes a massive difference on the ground.
The big challenge for me when I hear that, because it's something that really resonates with me as a consumer as well, but then I also know that, you know, beer is something that I'm passionate about to the point that I've made my life about it. And I do, you know, almost exclusively buy independent craft beer, not for any other reason apart from it's just an emotional choice for me, because I want to support and keep the small breweries going. And it's not the same philosophical, you know, it's not that storm the rampart sort of revolutionary spirit that probably did motivate me 15, 20 years ago. But then I have to keep reminding myself, well, you need to be willing to inconvenience yourself in the same way to go to an independent grocer or a food, you know, or a weekend market and avoid the convenience of the big two. And, you know,
correct. Yeah.
It's a lot of work being a considered consumer.
Well, that's right. And one of my kind of gripes about the on-prem market is that, you know, we've got this perennial debate about tap contracts and the big boys owning taps. And I'm fully in the camp of believing that that is, unfair competition, using market power unfairly, right? And it's an unfair marketplace. However, if you had consumers walking in to a pub, like what I always do is when I walk into a pub and I'm in a place that I don't know, doesn't matter what country I'm in, I say, what's your most local beer? I don't care what it is. Mm. I want to drink the most local beer. So which breweries do you have on that are local within 5-10 kilometers? Yep. Depends on where you are, obviously. And if consumers in Australia were willing to do that, we would not need tap contracts, would be a thing of the past, because essentially people would walk in and go, I don't want to buy the garlic from Mexico. I want to buy the garlic from Australia, right? I want to buy local beer. Instead, what happens is that the publican goes, I've got Tui's New, that's made in Lidcombe, right? That's about 5 or 6 kilometers away, and basically many publicans in old style pubs are like, well, I've got what I've got. If you don't like it, get fucked, you know? And unfortunately, Australian consumers go, oh, okay, I guess I'll just take what you're giving me. Now, if you opened a pub, a new bar in Portland, Oregon, and you didn't have 20 taps of independent beer, you'd get a rock through the window, right? So that's a whole different level of militance of supporting independence that I just don't think is in the Australian psyche, really. It's kind of like, oh, I'll take what you give me. So that's a challenge that really the IBA, it's the IBA's job. It's the whole industry's job, but you know, the industry working together under the IBA has to change that so that people understand that little independent logo is an important thing. It's an important criteria when you're shopping. And if you don't see that independent logo, you know, if I don't see Australian made garlic when I go to Woolies, I don't buy it. I don't buy the other.
Do you, where you don't have a choice, use as a brewer exclusively, you know, Australian malt and Australian hops, or, you know, that, I guess that's the other question is, you know, do you try and shape your styles based on what you can use from local ingredients, or do you shape the consumer market?
Look, we certainly try to. I think probably 95-98% of our malt would be Australian. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only the spec malts that we're looking for a very particular flavor profile that the Australian maltsters don't do or don't do well, that we would be bringing in that. Hops are a little bit different, right? Because there's a lot of terroir involved in hops. And, you know, Australian Cascade is not the same as US Cascade or New Zealand Cascade. So it's a little bit, if you want to, you know, if you want to, we don't make Mosaic in Australia, right? If you want a beer that has that flavor profile then you've got to, you know, I guess if you're cooking a meal and you want saffron, well, you know, you get Spanish saffron because it's the best, right? Yep. And it has a certain flavor profile, and you know, it's a relatively small part of the entire process. Mm. All our water is a strain. That's 95% of beer. So there you go.
And just talking about, you know, again, going back almost 10 years, you would have been brewing, you know, some of the styles that you launched on were some of the craft beer staples. But I look at the beers that Wayward's sending me these days, and some of those beers and styles weren't even conceived of back then. How much has the market changed, the consumer market and consumer demand changed for different beer styles?
Yeah, blue beers. Who knew that was a potential thing?
Well, that was your sports beer.
That was Sourade. That was done for Gabs. So that, you know, Gabs beer. We all get a leaf pass for doing Gabs beers. But I actually really like that beer. It's really quite drinkable, and you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it sees a bit of a comeback. But
it actually gets my tip for marketing of the year as well, because particularly, you know, within the confines of Gabs, I wonder whether ABAC would have something to say if it was done more widely, but within Gabs, it was brilliant, because I was trying to work out, I couldn't quite work out what it was, and I had to go looking for the Wayward seal.
I think uniqueness stands out at Gabs, and you know, people walking around with a blue beer really got people's attention, and so that was fun. So we kind of have this three or four, I guess, if you include seltzer product strategy, right? So we've got our core beers, which we really focus on drinkability. That it's that there's an indie beer for everybody kind of attitude. You know, we want to stay true to the Wayward way, which is kind of trying to introduce a little twist, but at the same time make it a beer that you could buy a slab of and drink the whole thing. You know, it's not beers you get bored of, not beers that are challenging, and that's our core range. The seasonal, or the limited releases, let's call them, not seasonals, because we do them monthly. The whole strategy there is just to keep things interesting. So it's beers that you probably wouldn't sell all year round, but beers that turn us on, the brewers that the brewers really love to brew, and just keeps it exciting, right? Keeps something new. So there's almost like a virtual sixth beer in the core range that's a limited release that comes out every month. And that's, you know, sometimes it's a blue beer, sometimes it's a black beer, sometimes it's I'm really excited about our next release, which is going to be going back to an old style of IPA. You know, everybody's doing cloudy and hazy IPAs and juicy IPAs. Well, what about super piney, you know, West Coast IPAs, super bright, really, really quite dry, quite bitter. You know, I love that throwback kind of IPA style, but it's probably not going to be something that you'd do 12 months of the year. Third tier of our strategy is our Discovery Series, which is all, it's like our limited releases or our barrel releases. So, as brewers, that's what, you know, barrel aging is, if I could put that as a style, it's, and sour beers and aged beers is probably the thing that I get most excited about in terms of actually creating a beer. Mm. So that's stuff that's never going to sell in much volume, but the margin is an offset, right? Because it's a higher ABV beer or higher cost beer. And I guess that's just trying to, one, be something that we really love doing ourselves. And I don't know, I guess there's a credibility. I don't know, it's one of those things. Some of my favorite beers in the whole world are in that style. And I guess from an aspirational standpoint, we all want to be want to have breweries that are thought of in those kind of groups of breweries.
Mm. It's an interesting strategy that you outline. I guess when you go back to some of the beers that we're consuming now that didn't exist, 10 years ago, do you think that their styles will have longevity, or that they're just satisfying the curiosity of the moment for, highly, attention deprived beer drinkers? Or do you see any that will have, some longevity to them? And secondly, how hard is it from a business to constantly change and evolve your lineup to try and cater to those, the whims of a consumer?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I think blue fruited gosas are going to be going to take over from hazy IPAs. It's going to be the next trend. Everybody's going to be releasing one. So some of the new stuff. So I mean, when you talk about new styles, I think we're all trying to find the next thing for sure, right? People. There was a year there where brut IPAs were a thing. Hazies seemed to be sticking around, primarily, I think, because any style that's really, really drinkable has a chance of longevity, right? It's got to be applicable and accessible by a majority of people. Anything that's so oddball is probably never going to become a dominant style and have a lot of longevity.
When you say the majority of people, you're talking about the majority of beer, of craft, like having said that we won't use craft anymore, that craft beer drinker, or the beer market more broadly, because I still get the feeling that the beer market more broadly is a completely different beast to that, idiosyncratic craft beer drinker.
Mm. Well, we're doing some research at the IBA now on really what's the next challenge for independent beer, right? So because ultimately what we've got to do is we've been living in this, if you know about the product adoption curve, where you have innovators, early adopters, early majority, late majority, laggards. We're moving up that adoption curve. So we started out with the innovators, right?
Yep.
Who are the home brewers and the real beer geeks that just have 1,000 check-ins on Untappd, and they're the people that are that know everything about beer. Then you've got the early adopters who, somebody gives them an accessible pale ale, like a Pacific ale, and they go, it's different. It's hoppier. I like this. It's fruitier. It's got some character to it. It's got some flavor, right? Those are the people that are willing to get co-opted into this whole world of independent, but aren't necessarily, they might not be on Untappd, right? Now we're moving into the early majority. That's the next phase. And the early majority are people who, maybe it's somebody who has a good job, has a bit of disposable income, and you know what? They like buying Asahi because Japanese beer must be good because Japanese things are good, right? Mm-hmm. And they might not even like the taste, or they might not even really like that. They're just buying it because it's delivering something to them that Tui's new doesn't, right? And those that early majority are the ones that we need to convert over to independent, right? We need to convince people that independent beer is every bit as good or every bit as cool as a premium imported beer. Right? It's the same price. It's just delivering something different.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to understand that consumer's mindset. And that consumer, it doesn't care where the hops were grown, or that there's 14 kind of varieties of hops, or yep. that it was done using a decoction mash, or they don't care about that. What they care about is, they do care about provenance and independence, right? So that's one thing where you talk to somebody who who's in that marketplace, and they might go, I don't want I don't necessarily want a big hoppy pale ale. I want something that tastes clean and tastes well brewed, and isn't too challenging to me, and delivers those other aspects of what I'm looking for in terms of what other my buying criteria. So we're doing a big research study. We just got some funding to do that. We'll leave that for another podcast to talk about that, because it's pretty exciting what we're going to do. And we're going to delve into the minds of the consumer and figure out what are the levers that we need to pull to convince people to do that. And then we need to get a consumer marketing campaign up and running to target that. So that's pretty exciting stuff that I'm...
And how about Wayward? You teased at the beginning that you're looking at expanding. So things are obviously going quite well for you, COVID and all, you're looking at expanding a new brewery, dare I?
We're not going to... So the Camperdown, so last year when we were approaching about 1 million liters, we said, oh, we're running out of space, so we need to figure out what we're going to do here. So we looked at some other spaces, creating building a brand new brewery, which would have involved, you know, raising massive amounts of money. Probably would have had to raise $15 or $20 million to do that. We had one that sort of wasn't the right deal for us and the right location for us. So we kind of made the call that we were going to just expand Camperdown. So we undertook a pretty massive reorganization. We took another unit. So now we have every unit on the laneway. Started out with two, and now we've got all six. And then we put in a new packaging line. We moved our brew house. We reorganized our cellar, reorganized our bright cellar. So we're now we just finished installing tanks that'll allow us to brew up to 2 million, maybe 2.5, depending on how much seltzer we do. Mm-hmm. But so we're in Camperdown for the duration, I think. If we hit 2.5, you know, our objective is that we want to hit this 2 to 2.5 million liters in the next 18 to 24 months. And if we do that, then we have another big decision to make. But at that point, you know, Wayward will be a profitable business by then. You know, we're implementing staff equity. So we're transitioning Wayward to an employee-owned business. And that's my horizon. And then if we achieve that, then I'll start taking a half a step back and pushing some of the staff into the main leadership positions.
We might have to come back and check in on you once some of those things are a little bit more advanced, because they sound they'd be well worth digging into a little bit more deeply.
Yeah, the staff equity thing has been a journey for us, and but it's something that we're pretty keen on and pretty committed to.
One thing that I'm conscious of the time, but one thing I can't let you sort of away with now that seeing you've raised it is seltzer. Tell us how has the seltzer worked out for you? It was a bit of a novelty when you guys brought it out. Are you pleased you did? Are you seeing growth, and do you think it'll be around for a couple of years, or that it might just be a bit of a flash in the pan?
I don't think it's a flash in the pan. It's pretty accessible. At the end of the day, you know, coming back to this drinkability, right? It's super drinkable, and it's tying into another thread that I'm pretty passionate about. That, and that's healthy consumption. You know, I live a low carb lifestyle myself, so having an option that's low carb, no sugar, no additives, all natural is pretty important.
To say seltzer is that automatically saying that beer isn't those things, that beer isn't healthy when you couch it in those terms?
Look, beer's definitely got higher carbohydrate than seltzer, right? Seltzer is brutally low carbohydrate.
But The argument has always been, you know, there were pubs that would sort of give you a Jats cracker or a couple of Jats crackers and say there's less carbs in a Jats cracker than there is in this beer. And now the conversation, as we've started making seltzer, is kind of, well, this is healthier. You know, the carbs in beer are still pretty low, is always been the industry narrative.
I think there's, look, I'm just off the top of my head, I think it's about 12 to 15 carbs. Don't quote me
grams
on that.
Yeah.
But for, you know, one standard drink, just roughly in line with wine, whereas seltzer is really one carb or two carbs, right?
But how many carbs is bad for you? Because if we're going to bandy around terms like healthy, it's a very relative term. You know, if carbs, you know, if one slice of bread has more carbs than two or three beers, and I don't know what it is.
I don't eat bread either. So there you go.
No, but that's the thing. So if you're avoiding carbs, that's one thing. But you know, I've always worried with low carb beers, for example, that it was a dangerous thing to position them as healthy because it almost, you know, without a big asterisk above it saying it's healthy if you are pursuing a low carb diet, as opposed to just saying it's healthy, because then that's...
Well, we don't say it's healthy. I don't think you can say alcohol is healthy. You know, there's lots of research on good things in red wine and actually good things in beer that are pretty good on a micronutrient basis. But I don't think that's what low carb's trying to do. What seltzers are trying to... We kind of got off on a little bit of a tangent here because we market the seltzer on the basis that it is low or no sugar, low carbohydrate, low calorie, right? And then people make their own decision as to whether that's the track that they're on. If they are looking for an option that's lower in carbohydrate, lower in sugar, and lower in calories, then seltzer is a reasonable option.
Yep.
Right. So, and I think just like there's there's a move towards, many people are wanting very low alcohol or no alcohol, right? That's another aspect that people are looking at. But there's a big part of the marketplace that's not necessarily anti-alcohol, but wants to control their carbohydrate and their calorie intake. So that's it. And it's a very convenient package to do that. I mean, you could always put a nip of gin in some soda water, and that's pretty low carbohydrate as well. Mm. But from a convenience standpoint, just grabbing a 4-pack or a 16-pack and going down to the park is pretty convenient. So to answer the original question, I think that trend that people looking for healthier options, I won't say it's healthy, I'll say it's maybe healthier, is here to stay for sure. People are,
but again, that's where I said the asterisk has to be, because even when you say healthier than beer, it's healthier on only one very, very narrow aspect of beer. And as soon as you say healthier, it makes beer healthier than beer. Same issue, we're seeing the ultra low alcohol beers marketed the same way. Well, these are healthier because they don't have alcohol. But then, given that you're using the metric of carbs, ultra low alcohol beers have significantly more carbs than regular beer.
And that's what you're looking for. I mean, it's
but that's where the terminology is.
If you don't like drinking alcohol, or you don't want to, or you're for religious reasons, then you don't drink alcohol. I mean, there's great beer options or great non-alcoholic options out there that mean that, that because these drinks become, at the end of the day, these drinks are social, they're used in social contexts, right?
Exactly.
So
yep.
If somebody wants to stand there and not get questioned, oh, why aren't you drinking? And they're drinking a non-alcoholic beer. Well, it looks like they're drinking a beer, right? And I know from speaking to some people that that's a thing, right? They want to be enjoying a beer, but not necessarily drinking.
So I didn't want to sort of get on the whole zero alcohol, but it's yeah. the marketing, you know, shouldn't we just stop at saying, well, this is a low carb, that seltzer is low carb, and that alcohol, that these low alcohol beers are low alcohol, rather than then.
But we don't say they're healthier. I mean, you can't say that alcoholic beverages have health benefits. So we don't say. I say I drink it because I think it's a healthier option, but way or it doesn't, market seltzer as this is healthier or healthy for you.
Okay.
So I think we put the numbers on there, and people make their own choice. And I know that from my standpoint, I look for low carbohydrate options, and not always. I still love my beers. But it's just one of those things that it's an occasion-based
Absolutely,
choice.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. Like I didn't mean to go down that rabbit hole, but even when you say that we don't say that they're healthy, both times we were sort of talking about it, you summarized the product by using firstly the word healthy and then the word healthier, rather than just stopping and saying, well, it's a low carb option, people want that, and not no criticism to you at all, but the number of media releases that we get, there is just this marketing, there seems this marketing imperative to just go beyond the physical attributes and then give it a qualitative element, it's healthier for you, or better for you. And we do get media releases that say that there is this thing that, to my way of thinking, automatically makes anything that isn't that product less healthy. And it's just something that we so easily fall into the habit of doing, which is just why I wanted to ask whether we needed to be careful about the language that we use when we describe it.
But look, I think it's been a great decision for us. We're expanding our range. The next thing I think is you'll see from us in the summer is limited releases. So going the same way as the beer market, where bringing it new flavors on a seasonal kind of basis, just to keep things interesting. And we've got some other cool product and packaging things in the pipeline as well.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to running those on our regular new beers section. But, mate, I just sort of suddenly realised what the time was, and having tried to wind it up with one last question, we've gone down a whole other rabbit hole. Peter Phillip, thank you very much. Great chat. Looking forward to seeing all of the news that sounds like it's going to be dropping, over a busy summer for you and covering it. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation about beer and brewing.
Yeah, no problem, Matt. It's been great having a chat.
And that was Peter Philp from Wayward Brewing with what I think might have been the quote of the podcasting year so far, that I think was, there's an independent beer for everyone, not necessarily a craft beer for everyone, which maybe it's selective bias, but we live in a post-craft beer world, as I say. But I thank Peter for his insights and his openness and a great conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Radio Brews News is proudly presented by Crye Malt. With over 25 years in the field, Crye Malt is dedicated to providing the finest brewing ingredients to help brewers create the foundations of a truly excellent beer. They are your premium brewing partner, and they are our premium partner in premium beer conversations, just like this one.